talk. I like to chat with people, as you could tell.
Yes. So. And I cannot thank you enough for the tour. I mean, it's just, if you have a chance to go, you have got to go to the Theater Guild. I want to thank my guest today, Jocelyn Fish, who is the Director of Marketing and Development at the Racine Theater Guild. And I want to thank you for listening on this edition of Generation Now. You can get this episode on our website, WGTD.org, and share it around with your friends online. We will see you next time. Bye, everybody.
This is WGTD-FM. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW-Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Jess Sheeler, an outreach and career transition specialist at Job Corps, Steve Brown, assistant professor of education leadership at UW Oshkosh, and former Kenosha Unified School Superintendent Joe Manji. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
And a very pleasant good morning and welcome to this edition of Education Matters here on WGTD HD, serving Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. I'm your host today, Steve Brown, and I am very pleased to say that we have two wonderful guests today. In segment one, my guest will be Cheryl Brown Henderson, and her father, Oliver L. Brown, is the person after whom the landmark U.S. Supreme Court case of Brown versus the Board of Education is named, and we'll be talking about a brand new book that Cheryl has published, and that book is called Recovering Untold Stories, An Enduring Legacy of the Brown v. Board of Education Decision. In segment two, I'll be talking once again with John Tinker. And Tinker versus Des Moines is celebrating the 50th anniversary of that landmark Supreme Court case dealing with the free speech rights of students and teachers. And John and his sister Mary Beth were recently in Des Moines, Iowa to celebrate the 50th anniversary, and we'll get an update of how things went for that wonderful event. I'm very, very pleased to welcome once again as my guest here on Education Matters, Cheryl Brown Henderson. Cheryl is one of the three children of the late Reverend Oliver L. Brown, namesake of the landmark U.S. Supreme Court case of Brown versus the Board of Education. She's also the founding president of the Brown Foundation for Educational Equity, Excellence, and Research, which was established back in 1988, and also owner of Brown and Associates, an educational consulting firm. She also holds a bachelor's in elementary education and a minor in mathematics from Baker University, a master's in guidance and counseling from Emporia State University, and an honorary doctorate of humane letters from Washburn University in Topeka, Kansas, and a brand new honorary doctorate of education from the University of South Florida. Cheryl, welcome to Education Matters once again.
Thank you so much. I look forward to our discussion.
As do I. Cheryl, we are primarily going to be talking about the brand new book that you have published, and it's called Recovering Untold Stories, An Enduring Legacy of the Brown versus Board of Education Decision. And of course, this year is the celebration of the 65th anniversary of that decision. And this is a project of the Brown Foundation for Educational Research, Excellence, and Research. And it's also published by the University of Kansas Libraries. First of all, how did this project come about? And then maybe we can talk about the overall focus of these Recovering Untold Stories.
Well, the project has been several years in the making. And really, the genesis is something I share with most of my college audiences, that if you don't tell your own story, somebody else will. And the plaintiffs in Brown v. Board of Education are a perfect example of that statement. Many, many books, hundreds of books, have been written about the Brown decision. Generally, they're written by legal scholars, occasionally by historians, But no book had been written through the lens of the people who stood with the NAACP and their legal team, the plaintiffs. And Jack Greenberg, in his book that was published in 2004, talked about the fact that before an attorney can bring a case, there have to be people willing to stand with them as plaintiffs. And we wanted their voices to be heard. We wanted people to understand that these were people that in the midst of their lives of going to school and going to church and, you know, going to their jobs, in the midst of all of that, they took a stand for social justice and helped move this country in a positive direction. So we wanted their voices to be heard, and they wrote their own stories, mm-hmm. and that was unique.
Mm-hmm. I know with the presentations that you and I have done that you always make a point when you talk about the actual title of the court case. And, you know, most people, and I'm one of them, when I talk about the case, a broad discussion of the case, if you will, I will typically say Brown versus the Board of Education. But that's not the real title of the court case, is it?
No, the court, actually the Supreme Court, when on its docket, there were four cases, Delaware, Virginia, South Carolina, and Washington, D.C., were the places those cases were filed and then appealed to the Supreme Court. Well, the Kansas case made its way to the Supreme Court, and all of these cases then were consolidated under the Kansas case. And that case was legally cited as Oliver L. Brown et al. Versus the Board of Education. Once they were consolidated, the court added an additional et al. At the end of the statement. So it really was the et al.s that we're trying to focus on with this book. It's E-T-A-L period, are four letters that the judicial system uses in class action cases rather than to list every single plaintiff.
Mm-hmm.
And in this instance, those four little letters really bury nearly 300 people and relegate them to legal wasteland, as I call it. Because unless you really do the research, and in our case, create a platform for them to tell their stories, they would largely be unknown.
Mm-hmm. In the introduction part of the book, there's a wonderful statement made by the current Attorney General in Kansas, Derek Schmidt. And he says, perhaps the most famous line from the Brown decision is this: "We conclude that in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. Separate educational facilities are inherently unequal." And he goes on to say, that passage is the poetry that explains in human terms the real significance of the legal prose that Brown declared to be the law. When this court decision took place in 1954 on May 17th at 12:52 p.m. What kind of impact did it have at that moment in time in Topeka, Kansas? And I know you always talk about how the schools were set up in Topeka, which a lot of people really don't realize how they were established there.
Well, a couple of things, a couple of points I'll make in light of your reading of the passage from Attorney General Schmidt. The passage that people generally choose to repeat from the 14-page opinion is not a passage I use because mm-hmm. I don't necessarily hold the belief that separate facilities are inherently unequal.
Mm-hmm.
With that said, the passage that I use refers to the importance of education and how no child can expect to achieve anything in life without the benefit of an education, and that education where the state has chosen to provide it must be provided on equal basis. Now, that passage I subscribe to, and it's certainly something that we all should work toward, that regardless of where we find our children, that they must be educated, and they must be educated in a fashion that affords them equal opportunity beyond their K through 12 schooling.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to make that clear. Attorney General Schmidt is eloquent in his writing, and I think legal scholars often stand by that passage without going any further. But it's always important for people to know that the decision was multifaceted, and the decision with many pages with other statements that were just or more compelling in my view. But Kansas was a place where schooling was unusual in that secondary school, meaning junior high, now called middle school, and high schools were already integrated. They'd been integrated early on. High schools were never segregated, and the junior high schools were integrated by an earlier case in Topeka. So with that said, we were really only looking at the 22 elementary schools, four segregated for African Americans, and 18 segregated for white children in Topeka. On top of that, there were only three cities in the state that had these segregated elementary schools. So we weren't talking about something that needed to be, you know, just sweeping and really broadly applied across the state of Kansas, because it was already a certain level of integration in neighborhoods and workplaces and at some level of education.
Mm-hmm.
So on May 17 and 54, when the case was decided in the fall of 54, then the public elementary schools then opened their doors to all students.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I know that I've heard you also talk about, as you talk now about how the schools were set up in Topeka, in particular, that at the high school level, even though the school itself, the high schools themselves were integrated, the sports teams were still segregated, weren't they?
So the interesting thing, a lot of what happens in our country. Law often follows custom, codifying something that people, a behavior, you know, practiced repeatedly by others. And Kansas was no different in that regard. The South and what emerged after the Civil War, I often tell audiences that the ideology of the South, the concept of white supremacy, made its way outside of the South and survived the Civil War, if you will. With that said, a lot of the segregation was based on social interaction.
Mm-hmm.
That's why at the high school level, all the academics were integrated. But anything that was considered a social interaction was then segregated, whether it was a school prom or an athletic program, cheerleading squads, that kind of thing. So Kansas wasn't 100% pure when it comes to early integration. They did fall prey to the social mores mm-hmm. of the era.
Let's talk more now about the book itself, Recovering Untold Stories, An Enduring Legacy of the Brown v. Board of Education decision. Obviously, with all of the cases that are part of the overall case, maybe if you could share a few of the stories based on what the individuals have written about their experiences.
The stories were absolutely emotional. We spent 2 years holding workshops at the National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. And over that period of time, with the facilitation of an English professor, a playwright who also was in the English department at the University of Kansas, a graduate student also in the English department, and an African American historian, myself, we spent time, first of all, nudging the participants, the plaintiffs, getting them to understand that even the simplest thing in their experience was something that was worth sharing and that people could learn from and would want to read. And after those discussions and really pulling from them, you know, their individual intimate stories, the next step was the craft of writing. Now, not everyone sits down and, you know, writes an essay about their life. So mm-hmm. it was a process, learning for them, learning for us in terms of their stories. So the stories that stand out to me were Delaware was unique. The state of Delaware, prior to Brown v. Board, at some level integrated their elementary and secondary schools in 1952. But it was only for the students, the children of the plaintiffs in the case that was brought early on. And it was a state judge that found in favor of the plaintiffs. So because it wasn't a sweeping decision that didn't affect everybody in Delaware in terms of African American children, they went ahead and the NAACP there developed a case that was also appealed to the Supreme Court, so they could in fact get statewide relief. So that was interesting. Delaware stories, they talk about how important it was. Education was always something coveted, and that's true universally by African Americans. So it was interesting to hear how the parents of the African American students in Delaware were so concerned and committed to make certain their children had the best educational opportunity possible. The children themselves, now, you know, older adults and writing the story, talk about the first day of integration. The first day they walked into a school that had been previously an all-white institution, you know, and how they felt. There was some anxiety. However, they quickly discovered, as we all know on the face of it, that children will be children. It's often the adults mm-hmm. that impose these biases and isms onto the children. So they talk about the first days, which turned out to be, you know, anxiety, but unnecessary, that they did make friends among the white students. They ended up getting very involved in school politics, addition to academics, athletics, yearbook, you know, just being children. And that impressed me, you know, beyond anything else. The fact that you have this anxiety, you worry about how you'll be treated, you're going to be in a building where you've got, you know, several hundred more teenagers that are white teenagers, but at the end of the day, everybody was simply being a teenager. That was inspiring. It says a lot about statements we make now about if children were not taught to hate, they wouldn't. The other story that really struck me, two more. One was the Virginia case, Davis versus Prince Edward County, Virginia, a school board. That case always strikes me because it was not organized by the NAACP. It was not organized by parents. It was organized by teenagers, led by a 16-year-old girl, Barbara Johns, who decided along with a couple of classmates that they would go on strike for a better school. And then they sought the help of the NAACP, who then turned it into legal action. The third story, the set of stories that really was impressive to me were yet again Virginia, but it was what happened after Brown v. Board. After Brown v. Board in 1954, several years later, 2 years later, I believe it was, the Virginia public school officials decided to close public schools in that county, and they were closed for 5 years. Mm-hmm. 5 years is an eternity for a young person trying to complete school. So I always wondered what happened to the students. There are essays in this book that talk about what happened. If they had relatives outside of the county, parents sent them there if they could afford to. Teachers from the north would come down and try to help them, to keep them from falling through the cracks. But more than anything, African-American students were sent to live with families outside of the South. And generally they were Quaker families, Friends families. And, excuse me, these were people that were willing to take them in. Also some African-American families took them in other parts of Virginia so they could finish their education. But they talk about how it was unnerving, if you will, not to have school to go to. And then secondly, being sent off to live with complete strangers. And in many instances, the complete strangers were white and were not people that looked like you. But that was what they had to do, the price they had to pay to finish their education. And on one hand, it's sad, you know, that adults in this country would feel so determined to hang on to this concept of white supremacy and not afford African-American children the same opportunity, that they would just close schools for everybody. There were some white academies that were opened. Legislative dollars were funneled into those academies. But it was shocking, you know, that it really goes back to the old adage that people will cut off their nose to spite their face.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the Virginia case is a prime example of that.
In the South Carolina case and the Briggs versus Elliott, and that those oral arguments when Thurgood Marshall did the oral arguments, and this was in December of 1953, and I'm just looking at the transcript here, and I've used this quote before, and in fact in the stage play that I wrote, we used this exact quote, where Thurgood Marshall said, "Those same kids in Virginia and South Carolina, and I have seen them do it. They play in the streets together. They play on their farms together. They go down the road together. They separate to go to school. They come out of school, and they play ball together. They have to be separated in school. There is some magic to it. You can have them voting together. You can have them not restricted because of law and the homes they live in." And then he goes on with, you know, that same sort of discussion. And that goes back to what you were just saying, Cheryl, that it's not the kids. It's not the kids doing these things. It's the parents. It's the community. It's adults who are as you've stated, you know, the isms, if you will. In a moment, I want to talk about where we are today in 2019. But as you look back at not only Topeka, but with since you have talked to and you've met with, as you have over the years, with many individuals from all of the cases, as they have talked to you and when their stories became part of this book, how do they see things then compared to how they see things today?
One of the people in the Virginia case went on to be an educator himself, actually more than one from Virginia, but this gentleman in particular stands out. And his essay concludes this set of Virginia case essays, and it is very well written. I think it strikes at the heart of things. He talks about how, you know, a cross had been burned on the lawn at the school when the students struck, and when the community recognized what it was the students were asking. He talked about becoming a principal and the challenges they faced because of the power, I believe, of the social narrative and popular culture.
Mm-hmm.
When we were growing up, probably clear through the 70s, maybe beyond into the 80s, you know, education was a must. People took it very seriously. Educators themselves were very much respected. Things had not been turned on their head as they have been now. So we have discussed how it's more difficult now to pull out of students the very best. It's more difficult now to get young people in the K-12 system to understand the importance of education. And it's more difficult now for educators, particularly teachers, to garner the respect they warrant, considering their importance in our country. You know, without education, you know, we don't have informed citizens. You know, nothing happens without education.
Mm-hmm.
So we have talked about it in that way. You know, how do we raise teachable children? How do we inspire them? How do we have them understand the importance of what they do in those classrooms? And that's what's changed, we all believe, the most.
Let's run the clock or calendar forward to right now to 2019 and talk about where you see things right now with regards to racism in our country. It's not like the discussion of race and racism is something new that all of a sudden is being discussed in the media. Where do you see our nation and how it's being discussed?
Well, I think right now we're in a very ugly period, that there's a lot of latent racism, you know, that had been lying dormant, I think. And for whatever reason, and I've yet to really figure it out, the election of 2016, of this current presidential administration, you know, seem to embolden these groups that have been largely operating you know, maybe on the dark web or someplace on the internet and doing their recruitment and their hate speech. But for some reason, it's emboldened them to turn the light on and proudly wear, you know, their biases. And it is unnerving that these days, you know, we are walking among, living among, working among people that have these notions that are now very willing to speak about them and act on them. I think some of the mass shootings in the synagogue in Pennsylvania, the AME church in South Carolina, the grocery store, when the gentleman couldn't get into the church and the door was locked, so he goes off to a grocery store and shoots people who are people of color. You know, I think we should all be absolutely frightened by this latest development. We should all be insistent, you know, that our elected officials in particular, our presidential administration that has a bully pulpit, to denounce this kind of behavior, discourage this kind of behavior, and sadly, you know, stop the rhetoric that is encouraging these actions. So I think we're at a very ugly and disquieting and you know, period in time, and one that many of us probably never thought we would see again. You know, naively, we thought we would keep moving forward, that progress would be just that, and the word progressive would mean that we're moving forward and becoming more a perfect union, but that's just not so. So I don't know what to say other than that 2020 is more important than any election we've ever had in the history of this nation. And it's important that we get this genie back in the bottle. And the only way to do that is to make sure we have leadership at the very, very top in this country that understands that we are one, that e pluribus unum means out of many, one. And we need to get back to that.
Yeah, and you ran for Congress when you were in Kansas. What year was that?
I believe it was 96.
As you look back at that campaign and compare that to, I mean, if you were running today versus when you ran in 96, would your campaign, this is kind of an off-the-wall question, but would your campaign today be different now versus how you ran it back in 96?
Yeah, it would be. It would be a different campaign. In 96, that was the emergence of the religious faith, the faith-based litmus test, when everyone had to wear their faith on their sleeve. And I remember telling people at my campaign stops that, you know, my father was a minister, and therefore, from birth, you know, all of my life has been lived as an active member of a faith-based organization. I would follow that up by saying it's not something I wear on my sleeve. I consider that very personal. So it's not something that I will talk about and not something I will attempt to use to garner votes. I would make that clear. But nowadays, I think I would be a lot more outspoken about the need to be inclusive and a lot more outspoken about things that our nation is a nation of immigrants, and make sure I point that out and talk about, you know, their this country in its evolution, you know, populated by people that we believe were native to the land. You know, talk about the progression of how our nation dealt with that population in an effort to expand in a westward. You know, it's greed and violence. You know, do we want to be those people again? And we'll talk about how the Southwest in our country, most of that land was owned by Mexico. And talk about those periods in our nation when we have not done so well when it comes to diversity, when Asian Americans helped expand the railways westward, and then Congress enacts a piece of legislation called the Chinese Exclusion Act, which bars people from Asian countries from immigrating to the United States, and how Mexican workers were used to help build railways in the Southwest, and then we're herded onto railroad cars and taken back to Mexico. Do we want to be those people where we use people, and then when we have no more use for them, you know, we deport them,
right?
Or we actively see to it that they come back and go back to their courts, their point of origin. I mean, it's cruel. Mm-hmm. It's absolute cruelty. And the separation of children, you know, right. How does one do that? And without thinking about the psychological damage, the harm that's being done to that child that has asked for nothing more than to be cared for, loved, nurtured, and allowed to be educated, grow, flourish, and contribute to society.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do we want to be those people?
Mm-hmm.
So my campaign would be a lot different, and I would be much more outspoken about those issues.
Before we wrap things up, how can someone read the entire book? What's the website they can go to? Because I know they can either read it online and they can also purchase it.
Go to the Brown Foundation website, which is just a simple little web address, brownvboard.org.
Okay.
Short for Brown versus the Board. So brownvboard.org. On the site, there is background about the book and then a link that would take you to a site called ScholarWorks. The book was published by the University of Kansas Libraries. So ScholarWorks is where a lot of the scholars then, from their dissertations and other books that they write, are able to upload those books so that people can read them and purchase them. So the book can be read online, or the book can be purchased, and it's simply a cost recovery. This is a nonprofit endeavor for $19.25. In a hard copy.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping your listeners will do that. It's an excellent book to use with your students, for
mm-hmm.
teachers that listen to your show. And it's certainly an excellent book for people that just want to know more about this aspect of our history.
Well, again, I want to thank you for once again being my guest here on Education Matters and talking about the book Recovering Untold Stories and Enduring Legacy of the Brown v. Board of Education decision. It's just a wonderful book. I've read probably 85% of it in reading through all the stories. And again, thank you for everything that you do, everything that the Brown Foundation does. And I really appreciate it. And also the opportunity over the years that you and I have had as far as publishing and presenting together.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I mean, it has meant a lot to me as well to have this writing partnership and having the opportunity to present together, and especially being in the audience when I first saw your play
mm-hmm.
At the University of Missouri Law School several years ago. So I appreciate you as well, Stephen, over the years, and I hope your listeners appreciate the show as well. Thank you so much.
Before we move on to the interview with John Tinker, let me just say this about Brown versus the Board of Education. 65 years ago, after the Supreme Court struck down segregation in public schools, the Brown v. Board of Education decision stands as a paramount symbol of both the power and the limitations of the law. More than anything, it reminds us, to paraphrase President Eisenhower, that the justices may be able to change the law, but they cannot change the hearts of men. As a result of the court's unanimous ruling in Brown on May 17th of 1954, segregation no longer is the law of the land. But in spite of the ruling, segregation still is a fact in America. It is an economic fact. It is a social fact. It is a fact in many of our public schools and neighborhoods. Even though the odious legal doctrine of separate but equal was scrapped thanks to Brown, no one can dispute that we are still very much both a separate and unequal society today. The Brown decision changed America, all right, but nowhere near as much as people would have thought back on May 17th of 1954 when Chief Justice Earl Warren read the ruling aloud from the bench to a stunned crowd of reporters and lawyers. There are plenty of reasons why the promise of Brown has gone significantly unfulfilled. First, the Warren Court itself is responsible largely because of the compromise it offered to opponents of school integration. Instead of ordering the public schools to be desegregated quickly, the court in its second Brown ruling, which came in 1955, called the Brown 2 decision allowed local authorities to proceed with all deliberate speed, a phrase that naturally encouraged integration foes to focus upon the deliberate and all but ignore the speed in creating racially neutral classrooms. It thus took years and years and countless other legal battles to generate anything like the sort of equality contemplated by the original authors of Brown. Once these authors were gone from the bench and replaced in the main by much more conservative justices, the Supreme Court itself began to undercut the impact of Brown and its immediate successor cases. On May 17th of 1954, the Supreme Court gave us a chance to consider what is possible in American life. It gave us an opportunity to embrace the better angels of our nature. The past 65 years, however, have shown us instead that what is possible often cannot be, and that the most noble dreams and goals usually are destined to remain only so. The Brown decision is one of the most important Supreme Court rulings of all time. And we continue now with segment two of Education Matters. The two court cases that are certainly the most important landmark cases that deal with anything related to education. One is certainly Brown versus the Board of Education, and also the case of Tinker versus Des Moines. And in the past, we've had John Tinker as a guest here on Education Matters, and he's the lead plaintiff in that case. John, welcome once again to Education Matters.
Thank you, Steve. It's great to be here.
This is the 50th anniversary of Tinker versus Des Moines, and the actual date of the celebration was February 24th, so this is about 2 weeks later when this will air. John, you and your sister Mary Beth were just in Des Moines, Iowa, and also up in Ames, Iowa, for a number of events for about 10 days, and this was part of the celebration. Maybe if you could just give an overview of the types of things you did and what the overall reactions were in terms of talking about this very important case dealing with the free speech and First Amendment rights of students.
Yeah, sure. Well, we did a number of different things. We spoke to grade school students, quite a few different classes. We spoke with high school students in different schools, and we also spoke to journalism students in different schools. We had an event at the State Historical Society where we had journalism students from all over the state attending, and there were students there from Parkland, Florida, and we talked about our case and about student activism generally. We had a couple of public meetings. We had a large meeting in Ames at the university there. We also had a big public meeting in Iowa City at the old Capitol. And that morning before we were in Iowa City, we were introduced to the Iowa State Legislature. A friend of mine is a representative in Iowa, and he introduced us. And it was quite wonderful, really, to have we received a standing ovation.
Wow.
From both Democratic and Republican representatives. It was very good. Regarding the reception that we got, it was just 100% positive.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's in favor of the First Amendment, and most everybody now realizes how important it is for students in the public school to also have their First Amendment rights.
Sure. And also, you did a wonderful C-SPAN. It was an hour-long C-SPAN. I believe that was on Sunday. I believe it was Sunday, wasn't it?
It was. It was a wintry blizzard blowing in Des Moines that morning. I got up at 5 a.m. and drove out to a studio, but It was a really good experience for me. I had a whole hour on C-SPAN, and I could wax philosophical about a number of things.
Yeah, and you did, and I watched it, and the thing that is really amazing, John, is that the call-ins, the questions were, you know, wide-ranging, and and it's just fascinating to me that, you know, 50 years later, and it's certainly no surprise to me or to you and to any of us who, you know, who follow and who know the case intimately, but just the continued interest, and I know I've asked you this before, but, you know, does it surprise you at all that literally 50 years later, that there is such an interest in the court case, in the findings of the case, and also the fact that people want to hear you and Mary Beth talk about the case?
Yeah, I'm not that surprised now, but if you would have told me 50 years ago that this would be happening, I would have been surprised then. We get a lot of very positive response. Basically, nobody is against the First Amendment. The First Amendment is very solid in the opinions of our fellow citizens, so that's a wonderful thing. And people across the spectrum rely on our decision, on the decision in our case, in order to have interactions within the public schools. So the freedom of speech is really appreciated across the political spectrum, and I find that very heartwarming.
Finally, maybe if you could just share briefly something about the Tinker Foundation. As our audience knows, I think from a previous interview that you and I did, that I'm involved in it. I'm on the board of directors, but what's the major goal or mission of the Tinker Foundation?
Well, the major mission is to advance the understanding both by students and by administrators and teachers about the nature of student and teacher expression rights in the schools. Basically, the principle that came out of our case, what's called now the Tinker Standard, educating everyone involved what that standard is, and also to encourage student speech, to help students realize that it can be done, and it may take a little bit of courage, but we really encourage the students to speak, and I'd like to see more discussion across the political boundaries of the issues that we all confront, and so it's sort of a free speech movement in general, but we're particularly focused at educating around the decision in the Tinker v. Des Moines case.
And for those who are not particularly knowledgeable of the Tinker Standard, it's essentially that students and teachers do not lose their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate, and then also that such speech should not create a material and substantial disruption. And so, I think that's something that school administrators still wrestle with. You know, how do you know if something might cause a material and substantial disruption? Something that that school administrators have always had to deal with, you know, before and after the Tinker decision back in February of 1969. So
that's right. I think a lot of administrators are, I don't see a great discomfort with trying to conform to what they call the Tinker Standard. It's because in the schools there's a special requirement for an educational environment that you don't have on the street. So the ability to set up a soapbox on the corner and preach whatever you want to on the street corner is inviolate. But in the school, it's important that the schools have an educational environment. So within that environment, to be able to express your opinion without disrupting the school, that's what it's all about. I think that schools are, that they have figured out how to do that. I'm not seeing a great disruption in the schools that are related to student speech.
John, as always, I want to thank you for being being my guest here on Education Matters, and I'm sure we will chat again. And thank you for all everything that you do and your sister Mary Beth, and Mary Beth has been a guest as well, and I'm sure we will be chatting again here on Education Matters.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. It's great to be on your show, and thank you for all that you're doing, and thank you for helping with the